From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Was the Oklahoma City bombing really the worst terrorist act on U.S. soil? We'll examine allegations of the bombing of Black Wall Street, what happened to a thriving African-American community in Tulsa 7 decades ago. But first, does American oil interests have anything to do with the crisis in Kosovo? And commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal on police brutality. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic removed Montenegro's army commander and 7 other top generals yesterday in what could be the first step in a crackdown against the republic's pro-Western government. The United States, meanwhile, warned that any attempt to undermine Montenegro's government could escalate the conflict with NATO. Serbia and tiny Montenegro form Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia's official Tanjug news agency said Milosevic's close ally was named commander of the 2nd Army Corps in Montenegro. There was no official explanation for the reshuffle, announced in the second week of NATO's air attacks on Yugoslavia and seen as an effort to tighten Belgrade's control over Montenegro. Christian religious leaders from the United States today urged an end to hostilities in Kosovo and the resumption of peace talks as their congregations begin Easter observances. The Serbian Orthodox Church filed a lawsuit in federal court in an attempt to stop the NATO bombings. 8 U.S. Catholic cardinals in joint letters to President Clinton and Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic urged a cessation of hostilities, while the head of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops outlined steps to end the, quote, unfolding human tragedy in the Balkans. Serb forces are systematically rounding up ethnic Albanians, herding them into trains and other vehicles and transporting them to the neighboring countries. This according to UN officials and arriving refugees. Refugees told of an apparent Serb campaign that NATO officials contend is aimed at altering forever the ethnic makeup of Yugoslavia's Kosovo province. Serb officials have said the refugees are fleeing NATO strikes. Pristina, the provincial capital, has become a ghost town. This according to refugees arriving in Macedonia, Albania, and Montenegro. Residents of the city were crammed onto a train and carried away, according to Judith Kuhman, spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva. Some 190,000 refugees have overwhelmed Macedonia, Albania, and Montenegro since NATO airstrikes began March 24th. Again, that according to the UN. At the same time, 2 Kosovo Albanian leaders reported to have been summarily executed by Serbs at the weekend are alive. This according to U.S. diplomatic and Kosovo Albanians. Femi Agani, a veteran politician who played a key role in the Rambouillet peace talks, and Baten Hakshu, the Koha Ditur newspaper editor-in-chief who voiced the aspirations of his people, had not been executed, as reported by NATO on Monday. The disclosures likely to prove embarrassing for NATO, which has stressed the pains it's taking to release only information it regards as factually accurate. Both NATO and Kosovo Albanian sources said it was heartening to know the 2 had not been killed, but other ethnic Albanians were being murdered, and in every possible case, these killings were being documented as evidence in future war crimes prosecutions. President Clinton said yesterday he holds Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic responsible for the capture of 3 army soldiers near the Macedonian-Yugoslav border, warning him to make no mistake and release them immediately. The U.S. initially branded the capture an illegal abduction on the assumption that Serb forces had crossed into Macedonia. But later yesterday, Pentagon spokesperson Kenneth Bacon called the soldiers prisoners of war, raising the specter they could be held until the end of hostilities. The Pentagon's investigating possibility that the soldiers had blundered across the Macedonian border into Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia said the soldiers were invaders and would face criminal trial before a military court today. Boris Yeltsin's envoy to the lower house of parliament said yesterday the president's not afraid of the upcoming impeachment debate against him. The impeachment drive is expected to fizzle, just like past attempts, but even debating it would hurt Yeltsin, whose authority has been crippled by frequent illnesses and Russia's economic crisis. Enemy planes bombed southern Iraq today, destroying two houses in the first U.S.-led airstrikes reported in more than 2 weeks, according to Iraq's military. Aircraft, including F-14s, F-16s, and Tornadoes, carried out 18 sorties from Kuwaiti skies and 33 from Saudi skies, the official Iraqi news agency said, quoting an unidentified spokesperson for the Air Defense Command. U.S. military officials were not immediately available for comment. And the Iranian government is making progress toward building a more tolerant society that recognizes human rights. This, according to a United Nations expert. However, the Islamic Nation should remain under special scrutiny at the UN Human Rights Commission for at least another year because the UN says that improvements are not extensive enough. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and it's been quite an eventful week this week.
It certainly has been.
Yeah, I was up in the Bronx on Wednesday during the indictments, when the indictments were unsealed against four police officers in the shooting of Amadou Diallo, and it was an amazing scene as literally hundreds of police had the whole area cordoned off in what I would call an immense overkill when it comes to security, just basically to watch over two contending demonstrations, one of off-duty police officers in support of the cops and of several hundred demonstrators demanding justice in the Diallo case. But I have to say that the district attorney of the Bronx, Robert Johnson, displayed uncommon valor for a district attorney in this city for bringing second-degree murder indictments against these police officers. And Johnson is going to take a lot of heat over the next few weeks and months for that decision. But his investigators firmly believed that on the evidence that they had, and because of the failure of the police officers to testify before a grand jury, that there was sufficient evidence for an almost unprecedented second-degree murder indictment.
You know, it's interesting, Juan, Robert Johnson's history as district attorney of the Bronx, and I really think this has national significance. On the one hand, you had the protesters originally saying they wanted a special prosecutor. They didn't think that a local community district attorney who works so closely with the police could be objective. And this is an issue that's raised all over the country often when it comes to cases of police brutality. The officials, like Mayor Giuliani and the governor of New York, who has higher aspirations, George Pataki, insisted that that's how it was going to be, and he came down with this decision. Now, Robert Johnson is no stranger to controversy, because when New York passed the death penalty, he actually spoke out against it. And as a result, in one of the first cases, a death penalty case in New York, the governor of New York, George Pataki, took a case out of his hands, saying he couldn't deal with that case.
Yes, and you have to understand, for those who are not familiar with New York City, there are five district attorneys in New York City, one for every one of the counties that compose the city. And I think there are something like 80-something district attorneys around the state. Robert Johnson is the only African-American district attorney in all of New York State. And he has, in the past, certainly in the last decade, been the only district attorney who has been willing to actually go after police in a few instances, not many, and he has been under criticism in some cases, but he definitely has attempted to go after police in several instances of questionable shootings, so that he's especially under fire. But the interesting thing was not only what he said in court, but in this press conference subsequently, he said not only as a law enforcement official, but as a person of color who lives in the Bronx, he said he'd reached the conclusion that fear and this is a quote from his statement, fear and frustration abound. Troubling questions have been raised, particularly in communities of color, but not limited to them, regarding police-community relations, civil liberties, and the issue of respect. which is an unusual statement for a district attorney to make, especially in the midst of such a high-profile case.
Juan, since you were there when the indictments were handed down against the four police officers, did you get a chance to speak to some of the hundreds of police officers rallying around them about why they were there?
Yeah, most of them were from the street crime unit, which is the one, the unit that the four officers were from. And
whose motto is, "We own the night."
I think it's whose motto was "We own the night," and interestingly enough, you know what? One of the Reverend Al Sharpton had a great statement. He's famous for his one-liners. Yesterday morning at a breakfast, because Commissioner Safer has changed the uniforms, put the street crime unit back into uniforms as a means of helping to break down the conflicts with the community. And Sharpton said, "You know, when my two daughters misbehave, I don't send them to their room to change their clothes. I send them to their room to change their behavior." Sharpton criticized this attempt at changing costumes rather than attitudinal problems and within the police department and training methods that result in these kinds of tragedies.
Well, yesterday, Amadou Diallo's mother made an emotional plea for understanding to the wives and children of the four New York City police officers who fired 41 shots at her son. A day after the officers were charged with second-degree murder, Kadiadu Diallo said the cops know what they have done and asked their families to come to grips with it. As lawyers in the case prepare for trial, Mayor Giuliani, who's come under fire amidst massive displays of civil disobedience in front of police headquarters, 1,200 arrests, has decided to keep silent. Meanwhile, the five New York City police officers charged in the 1997 torture of Haitian immigrant Abner Louima asked yesterday that their trial be delayed 4 months because of what they characterize as inflammatory publicity about them and the New York Police Department. Earlier this week, defense lawyers asked the judge in the case to dismiss 600 potential jurors because several gave television interviews. Well, at the beginning of every month, Democracy Now! Airs All Things Censored, commentaries written by journalists and death row resident Mumia Abu-Jamal and produced by Noel Hanrahan of the Prison Radio Project. The Pennsylvania Department of Corrections has banned new recordings of Mumia's voice, so we bring you notable people reading his essays. This month, Bear Lincoln reads Legalized Cop Violence, but first a short introduction to Lincoln. On April 14, 1995, Bear Lincoln was ambushed by the Mendocino County Sheriff's Department in Northern California. Sheriff Bob Davis and another man died in a rain of gunfire. Lincoln was tried and acquitted of first and second-degree murder charges by an all-white jury for the officer's death. On April 23, the district attorney will decide whether to retry Bear Lincoln for manslaughter. It's ironic that Bear can read you this commentary because he's not allowed to speak in his own defense. A California court has barred him and his attorney from speaking about the case or publicly proclaiming his innocence. Bear Lincoln's reading of Legalized Cop Violence, written by Mumia Abu-Jamal, was recorded at the Round Valley Indian Reservation.
My name is Bear Lincoln. Mumia Abu-Jamal's deep and resonant voice has been silenced and censored. I will read to you one of his illuminating commentaries. These words were handwritten in a solitary confinement cell by a man awaiting execution. Legalized Cop Violence by Mumia Abu-Jamal. Quote, when a gang member is beaten by persons unknown in a mixed neighborhood and the black gangs begin terrorizing whites, it is called racism. A bunch of cops can ride through black neighborhoods all day beating ass and calling it law. When a bunch of blacks beat one of these cops' ass, it's called mob violence. End quote. John Africa, May 1967. A young woman engulfed in a diabetic coma while sitting in her car is repeatedly shot at by a corps of cops who say they are threatened by the young woman. Taisha Miller of Riverside, California, becomes a statistic. A young man sitting in his car in North Philly is surrounded by a phalanx of armed cops whose guns are pointed at him from all points. He's ordered to raise his hands. When he does so, he is shot to death by one of the cops, who insists he thought he saw a gun. The 18-year-old is unarmed. Dante Dawson becomes a statistic. An immigrant comes to America, taking an apartment in New York's Bronx borough. When four New York Police Department cops approach his door, reportedly because of a suspected rape, he was not a suspect. He was shot at 41 times. 19 shots hit him. Amadou Diallo was unarmed and will never return to West Africa. In case after case after case, in city after city, from coast to coast, such cases arise with alarming regularity, worsened by the realization that in most cases, cops who have committed these acts that if committed by others would constitute high crimes will face no serious prosecution, if any prosecution at all. They are, the corporate media assures us, just doing their jobs under an awful lot of pressure or in fear, and therefore justified in what they do. In the language of the media, the very media that make their millions off of the punishment industry calling for the vilest sentences known to man, turn in the twinkling of an eye into paragons of mercy, who lament that the fine young men who serve their community are in trouble or have suffered enough. The suffering of the slain because they are young and black are all but forgotten in this unholy algebra that devalues black life, while heightening the worth of the assailants because they work for the state. The worst lie that is often trotted out when such cases occur is when politicians and media people sing the praises of such people who are called by virtue of their jobs public servants. Since when have servants of any kind acted in the vile, arrogant, monstrous manner that many of these cops do in black, Hispanic, and poor communities? Since when have such servants been in the position to slaughter, shoot, humiliate, and imprison the very public they are sworn to serve? They are servants, if at all, of the public structures of which they are a part, not of the people. They are servants, if at all, of the state. They serve the interests of capital, of the wealthy, of those who run the system from their bank vaults and corporate offices. They do not serve the poor, the powerless, nor the uninfluential. They never have. They are an armed force organized to protect the interests of the established and those who own capital. The history of labor in this country is splattered by the blood of trade unionists who were beaten, shot, and crushed to the earth for striking against the trusts, combinations, and mega corporations of capital. Who did the beating, the shooting, the crushing? The cops who served the interests of a state that declared, as did the Supreme Court, that unions were criminal conspiracies, and that the Constitution was based upon the concept that the fundamental private rights of property are morally beyond the reach of popular majorities. Capitalist voice, the media, and their agents, the politicians, unite in a chorus of support for their legalized killers who bomb babies with impunity. Remember May 13, 1985, Philadelphia, who shoot unarmed kids in their cars and unarmed African immigrants, whose only capital crime is being black in modern-day America. This legalized violence that they do daily proves that violence is not a problem to the system when it is theirs against the people. This awful crime must cease.
That is Bear Lincoln reading Legalized Cop Violence, a commentary written by Mumia Abu-Jamal, who sits on death row in Pennsylvania. Coming up on the show today, we're going to take a look at whether, in fact, the Oklahoma City bombing was the worst terrorist act on U.S. soil, or was it something that actually happened seven decades ago in the 1920s? A bombing of, was there one, of Black Wall Street, as a black community was known in Tulsa, Oklahoma? And after the break, though, first, we're going to look at U.S. oil interests in Yugoslavia and see if they have anything to do with the crisis in Kosovo. But before we do that one, in the minute we have before the break, you were looking at an interesting piece in the New York Times this week about Brazil.
Yeah, there have been several articles buried deep in the financial pages of the New York Times and some other Wall Street Journal, some other publications, about the an investigation that has been started in Brazil of a bunch of Brazilian and U.S. banks that include Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, and Bank Boston, who apparently profited by roughly $1 billion by betting on the devaluation of the Brazilian currency that occurred in January. Now, just think of it. Millions and millions of Brazilians were thrust into poverty by the sudden devaluation of their currency, something that had been delayed because there was a presidential election last December that nobody wanted to risk the possibility of the Workers' Party of Brazil winning. And suddenly the devaluation thrust millions of Brazilians into poverty, and yet there were a group of U.S. banks, together with some Brazilian bankers, betting on the devaluation of the currency, and they raked in $1 billion in profit. It's a scandal of enormous proportions because it's based on the fact that they had inside knowledge of when the devaluation was coming, and the results of the investigation should be very, very illuminating.
And we will certainly cover that investigation. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Well, as we said earlier, Serb forces are systematically rounding up ethnic Albanians, herding them into trains and other vehicles and transporting them to neighboring countries, at least this according to UN officials and refugees who are getting out. Meanwhile, with the discovery of vast energy reserves in countries bordering the Caspian Sea, just a few hundred miles from Yugoslavia, the region has been catapulted onto the world stage. The U.S. waging a campaign to win influence in the Caspian as are Russia, Iran, and other nations. With intense competition for oil and gas pipeline routes, this has become the newest arena for global power politics. And multinational giants like Shell, BP Amoco, Chevron are positioning themselves to grab a share of the Caspian petroleum market. Today we're going to look at the crisis in Kosovo as just one piece of this larger geopolitical struggle stretching from Southeast Europe, the Mediterranean, to the oil-rich area of the Caspian in Central Asia. We're going to begin with a report from Pacifica Network News' Jeremy Scahill.
With bombs shelling Yugoslavia every day and the ongoing attacks in the so-called no-fly zones in Iraq, the Pentagon seems to be fulfilling its goal of fighting two wars at once. But away from the media glare, there is another high-stakes standoff unfolding just north of Iraq and a few hundred miles east of Yugoslavia. The battleground? The Caspian Sea Basin, an area which is already a major player in world oil politics, second only to the Persian Gulf. Right now, it's up for grabs with more than 20 countries vying for control.
There are a lot of people who see this as the second coming of strategic competition with old enemies like Russia.
Michael Lelyveld is the chief correspondent of the Weekly Journal of Commerce. He points out that following the fall of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, the geography of the territory bordering the Caspian Sea in the east changed dramatically as former Soviet republics gained independence. Places like Azerbaijan, Georgia, and Tajikistan became new nations. With these changes came others, one being that a major potential oil market was up for grabs and no longer dominated by Russia, and now the U.S. wants in. Dr. Ariel Cohen is a senior analyst at the right-wing Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. He says controlling regions such as the Caspian Sea will ensure American prosperity.
One of the key commodities is oil, and oil became expensive in the 70s and the 80s because Arab countries tried to use it as a political weapon and drive the prices up to show political clout. And what happened as a result is that areas around the world where you can find oil became producers. It didn't exist in the 50s and 60s. Most of the oil in the world was coming from the Middle East. One of such areas with abundant oil is the Caspian Sea area.
The Caspian Sea reserves are estimated to hold more than 200 billion barrels of oil, worth up to $2 to $4 trillion at current market prices. The region's reserves of natural gas are similarly enormous, larger than those in all of North America. And there is an enormous consortium of corporations and countries looking for a piece of the action, including Mobil, Shell, Total, and Chevron. And the question is, who will control the oil flow and how? Michael Lilleveld from the Journal of Commerce says the scenario the U.S. wants to avoid is one where Russia or Iran would gain control of the lucrative Caspian Sea oil market. And that's why the U.S. has been pushing for a westward flow.
The feeling here is that if pipelines from the landlocked Caspian travel through either Russia or Iran, then there is the opportunity for domination of this region by one or the other powers.
The issue of the Caspian pipeline debate is in fact connected to the current attacks against Yugoslavia. The government of Turkey has stated that it doesn't want oil tankers passing through the Bosporus because of potential environmental dangers, and that could possibly lead to a different route for the oil flow.
That is going to raise the question of a pipeline across the Balkans.
Diana Johnstone is a journalist who has written extensively on the Balkans.
As things are going, the United States through NATO is planning to, arranging to occupy the territory the pipeline would be on. But I think that there's another reason, too, which is more general, which is to establish NATO as the instrument that can go anywhere in defense of U.S. interests. And that is to say, if it can go in the Balkans, it can go farther east.
The conflict in the Caspian Sea may very well mean a U.S. military presence in the Caucasus is inevitable. Indeed, Pentagon representatives have increased their contacts with various governments in the area. On top of that, a senior Azerbaijan security official is requesting that NATO move its airbase at Incirlik in Turkey to Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, which is the effective Caspian oil capital. It is also where all the oil pipelines would originate. Again, Michael Lilleveld of the Journal of Commerce.
This obviously has two purposes. One is to extend the NATO security umbrella to Azerbaijan and protect its oil from Russian pressure and Russian encroachment. But the second reason is clearly to lock in this region to Western orientation.
Ultimately, from Yugoslavia to Iraq and now to the Caspian Sea, U.S. interests remain the same. Again, Ariel Cohen from the Heritage Foundation.
Well, we would like to see, you know, every great power exports its form of government abroad. The Romans did that, the British did that, and the U.S. is doing that.
Jeremy Scahill, Washington.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're joined on the phone by Michael Lilleveld, chief correspondent of the Daily Journal of Commerce. The Caspian Sea, a California-sized body of salt water, the world's largest landlocked body of water, may sit on as much as 200 billion barrels of oil, which would be 16% of the Earth's potential oil reserves. Even at today's low prices, that could add up to $3 trillion in oil. Michael Lilleveld, do you agree with Diane Johnstone that that could have something to do with NATO and U.S. interests in Kosovo and Yugoslavia right now?
Well, it's the link, I think, the more logical link to Yugoslavia is the question of where NATO goes and what kind of commitments we make. One way to look at this region, which is bounded by the Caucasus in the west and by Central Asia in the east, is that it's a place where many of the things, many of the elements that exist in Yugoslavia also exist. And there are ethnic tensions. There is a terrain where it would be very difficult for troops to come in and establish security. There are many factors there that are very familiar to people and who have followed the conflict in Kosovo. And unfortunately, one could say that it is the next Kosovo. Another way of looking at it is that a lot of conflicts in this region have already happened. There's been a lot of bloodshed that the American public and the U.S. government really haven't paid any attention to, as they are now to Yugoslavia. We've had wars take place on a massive scale in Chechnya, where the United States chose not to take any stand or any interest. They treated that as an internal affair of Russia, perhaps 100,000 people killed. There is a war similarly between Azerbaijan and Armenia for the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh that has resulted in the displacement of 1 million refugees. This is something where we've taken an interest only because, I believe, because of the oil and the pipeline access that we want to secure there. The question now is whether our interests are going to extend to security guarantees for this region and commitments in order to make sure that the pipelines out of this region go the way we want them to go. And that is a very dangerous proposition.
But Michael Lelyveld, with oil prices at historic lows and all the reports talking about an oil glut in the world, and clearly there are other sources that still have enormous potential and the possibility of Iraq once again becoming a supplier, why all of this jockeying and battling over future reserves or future production sources?
You're asking the right question. I think one of the answers to this, first, it lies in the figures that you've quoted and are so often quoted about the 200 billion barrels of oil in the Caspian. It's correct to say that there may be 200 billion barrels. However, it's more likely that the proven reserves will turn out to be something along the lines of 20 or 30 billion barrels. And there's already been disappointment on the part of many of the oil companies as a combination of finding that many of the wells that they've drilled in the offshore Caspian have come up dry or turned out to be gas instead of oil. They've spent a lot of money. Getting oil out of the Caspian is obviously much more expensive than taking it out of Saudi Arabia or the Persian Gulf because it is landlocked, it is isolated. There aren't pipelines built yet to get the oil out, not major pipelines. And there are enormous political pressures in all directions. So the potential has been somewhat overblown, although it may come back if prices improve. When prices fell dramatically last year, most of these companies had to take dramatic cuts in their capital budgets, and a lot of them had to reevaluate their commitment to this solution, this pipeline solution, which is very expensive, of taking pipelines out to the west rather than through Russia or Iran, both of which routes are really opposed by the U.S. government. But the U.S. government continues to play a strategic game in the region, which is not based on oil prices. It's not really based on economics. It's really based on politics and how we want to see this region aligned. We should keep in mind that this is a very long way from U.S. shores. This is a place where we have gotten involved originally because of business, just plain business.
Michael Lelyveld, can you name again the companies, and particularly the U.S. companies, that have interest there? And then expand on what you said earlier about making this an issue of national security, that once again we would see the U.S. saying possibly we have to move in because now it's become a region that affects our security.
Well, I would say that the biggest purely U.S. company at the moment and the one that's been involved in the region for the longest time is probably Chevron, because going back to the days of the Bush administration, Chevron became involved in Kazakhstan developing the enormous Tengiz oil field, which is in the north of the Caspian. Most of it is really onshore. However, there are huge reserves in the offshore portion of the Caspian Shelf region in Kazakhstan. What's interesting about the exploitation of the offshore interests in Azerbaijan, which is further to the south, is that much of that was American until the recent oil mergers. Now that BP has taken over Amoco, and is expanding again this week to include ARCO. This is becoming less and less of an American company-dominated interest. However, the American strategic interest continues to be one that the U.S. government stresses, and that is one basically that has to do with making sure that this oil goes in the direction that we want. And I have to stress that none of this oil is supposed to come to the United States. This is not oil that is going to be piped here. It's not oil that's going to be shipped here. As far as I know, not a single drop of this oil is going to come to an American shore. This is oil that is destined for European refineries, for European use. So we have two separate things going on. One is business, and the other is what we have identified as strategic interest. I think it's debatable to call this a national security interest, as some people have called it. I don't see the national security stake. This is business.
Michael Lelyveld, I'm looking at something on the website of Project Underground, which is an environmental human rights group based in California. And it says, throwing her weight behind Chevron is Elizabeth Jones, the U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan. The American ambassador sports a yellow bumper sticker on her car that reads, "Happiness is multiple pipelines." Free copies of the sticker are available to visitors to the embassy she heads up in Alma-Ata, the Kazakh capital.
Well, we've seen the bumper sticker, and it started as a bit of a joke a couple of years ago. The question here is whether happiness is oil, period, not just the question of pipelines. There has been a debate going on for 3 or 4 years now as to whether pipelines bring peace. And we're talking about a region where the gap between rich and poor is enormous, where there are refugees and unresolved conflict, where the president of probably the most democratic country in the region, or the only genuinely democratic country in the region, which is Georgia, and this is Edward Shevardnadze, has to survive assassination attempts on a regular basis. This is a very, very difficult and often bloody region. The question is whether all this competition and tension over pipelines is going to bring peace, because everybody has a stake in making money from the transit fees and from the sale of oil, or whether, in fact, it's going to be a source of conflict. One of the major, major issues here is that the oil flow that the United States wants to establish with the building of a pipeline would go through the Caucasus to Turkey, and would cross Turkey and come out on the Mediterranean Sea, rather than going into the Black Sea and through the Bosphorus. This pipeline would skirt the Kurdish areas, where, as you know, there's a very great dispute. The Kurds want their own state. This is the scene of a very bloody war. The pipelines going to this area are blown up on a regular basis. The port of Ceyhan, the Turkish port of Ceyhan on the Mediterranean, is also the terminus for the Iraqi pipelines. And the Kurds regularly blow these things up to sabotage Turkish economic interests.
Well,
are we going to get into a situation where we guarantee that kind of security and commit forces or troops to it? That's a big question.
Michael Lelyveld, I want to thank you for joining us. Certainly paints a different picture and a different perspective for people to start looking at, perhaps a new lens to start looking at Kosovo as well as other areas in the region. Michael Lelyveld, chief correspondent of the Daily Journal of Commerce. Folks, stay with us after the break. We're going to look at an absolutely incredible story. It happened 7 decades ago, but it may dwarf the Oklahoma City bombing. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. This week, Oklahoma City bombing conspirator Terry Nichols, already serving a life sentence in federal prison, has been charged with 160 counts of murder by state prosecutors who vowed to seek the death penalty. Nichols is in prison for conspiracy in the deaths of eight law enforcement officers in the April 19, 1995 bombing of the Alfred Murrow Federal Building. Hundreds were injured. 168 people were killed. However, little is said of the first bombing in Oklahoma, one that occurred 78 years ago. On June 1, 1921, Greenwood, the prosperous African-American community of Tulsa, was looted and burned by a white mob numbering in the thousands. This came after false rumors that a black man had assaulted a white woman in an elevator and an editorial in the Tulsa Tribune calling for whites to lynch a Negro tonight. Eyewitness accounts tell of aerial bombing, internment camps for black men, and truckloads of corpses dumped into unmarked mass graves. 35 city blocks were completely destroyed, and experts believe as many as 300 people died. If this is so, then the Tulsa race riot of 1921 surpasses the Oklahoma City bombing as the largest mass murder of civilians on U.S. soil. Following the 75th anniversary of the massacre, the Tulsa Race Riot Commission was formed to establish an historical record of the massacre and search for the remains of the hundreds of victims. Recently, the commission has uncovered three sites where victims may be buried in mass graves. We're joined right now by three people to talk about what happened in the 1920s. Bob Blackburn is deputy director of the Tulsa Historical Society and chair of the commission. Oklahoma State Representative Don Ross is one of the leading figures behind the creation of the Tulsa Riot Commission. And George Monroe is with us. He is a survivor who was 5 years old at the time of the riot. His family's home and business were destroyed during the Tulsa massacre. Well, George Monroe, as people's jaws drop when they hear this, can you describe what you understand happened? You survived it, though you were a child at the time. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we're going to get George Monroe right now on the telephone. George Monroe, again, is a survivor who was 5 years old at the time of the riot. Juan, let me ask you, had you ever heard about the story?
No, I had never heard the specifics of it. I had heard that there was a Tulsa race riot in 1921, but never the specifics of what had happened there.
Well, let's see if we can get George on the phone right now. George Monroe, are you there? George Monroe, can you hear us?
Hello.
Hi, can you hear us?
I barely can hear you. I just barely can. I can't make out what you're saying, but I heard my name called.
Well, can you tell us what happened in 1921 in Tulsa?
Yes, I can tell you what I remembered. Excuse me for speaking so slowly, but this is, I hope you are hearing me better than I could hear you.
We hear you absolutely clearly.
Well, fine. I will just go along and try to answer the questions that you ask me, but I will tell you as to things that are outstanding in my memory that I shall never forget. First, you must realize I was a five-year-old child. Our home and our property was right next to Mount Zion Baptist Church, which was located at the corner of Easton and Elgin Streets here in Tulsa on the north side of the city. Now, you must understand that in Tulsa, Oklahoma, there has always been what we call a north side of the city and a south side of the city. The South was predominantly white, and the North was predominantly black. And that's the way it still is in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, what I do remember more than anything else is that my mother and we four children, two boys and two girls, were in our home right next door to Mount Zion Baptist Church. And we looked out the front and we saw four men, white men, with torches coming toward our house. When my mother saw this, after hearing the bullets and the shooting and all the conglomeration outside of the yard, she put us under the bed. It was four of us. Okay, I was the last one to get in. When these men came in the house with these burning torches, all four of them, when they came in, one stepped on my finger, because we were kind of crowded at four under the bed, and one stepped on my finger. And when he stepped on my finger, my sister put her hand over my mouth to keep me from screaming. And that was the only reason that they didn't find us under the bed. Now, I remember that. And guns shooting and fires everywhere. I remember that at 5 years old as to when I won't remember anything else. Now, I have told this story in and around when people ask me about the race riot here. And I do remember that. Now, they've asked me other questions about where the dead was buried, and a lot of questions that I couldn't answer at 5 years old. But what I remember, I do remember, because it happened right in my neighborhood as to where I spent every day. I've got a lot of instances that I remember, little things that I remember, and coming up at 5 years old.
Well, Mr. Monroe, yes. We'd like to bring in Dr. Bob Blackburn, who is the deputy director of the Tulsa Historical Society, and he's the chairman of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission. Dr. Blackburn, what about these reports of aerial bombings? Did this actually happen, and who did it, if it did happen?
Yes, it's good to be with you today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. I'm deputy director of the Oklahoma Historical Society, a state agency. Okay. But I'm working with the Tulsa Historical Society and the North Tulsa Historical Society on this. But to answer your question, one thing we have done is tried to build as big of a database as possible with all accounts of the riot, both oral history accounts as well as documents, city directories, warranty deed records, maps. And at this point, we are fairly certain that there were airplanes flying over the district, and they were dropping incendiary devices on the community. At this point, we cannot say without a doubt who was in those airplanes. We think that there were some airplanes being flown by reporters. We think there were law enforcement officials in some of the airplanes. We think that there were civilians flying the airplanes, doing different things. We're still on the search to pin down individuals. We know how many airplanes there were in Tulsa at the time. We know where they were in the hangars. We know now when people saw them. Just recently, we've had more oral history accounts of people protecting young black children who were being fired upon from airplanes. So right now, we can say with certainty that there were airplanes involved in the attack. We're still trying to determine who was in those airplanes and what they were doing.
What do you mean journalists were flying in the planes?
We have had accounts, and we're still trying to find out about this, but we have heard that the New York Times sent a correspondent to try to find out what was going on during the riot. It was after most of the destruction had occurred, but the story we received is that the New York Times hired a local photographer to take aerial photographs of the destruction. We have searched the New York Times from the records we have here in Oklahoma. I cannot find that it was ever published. We have asked for a search of the New York Times archives to see if those photographs might have survived somehow. We still have not found those, but that's one lead we are following.
Dr. Bob Blackburn is Deputy Director of the Oklahoma Historical Society and Chair of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission. We're also joined by Oklahoma State Representative Don Ross, who is one of the leading figures behind the creation of this commission. Representative Don Ross, what do you understand at this point, and when do you plan to have this report presented?
I think at the last commission, Dr. Blackburn and the commission thought that we might be able to have at least a preliminary report this fall. Research is still continuing, as Dr. Blackburn said, and certain leads that we can't nail down. We haven't nailed down.
When you hear that the Oklahoma City bombing, is the worst terrorist act that took place in U.S. soil, and that's something that took place in 1995, have you been aware all along that this other attack that took place in 1921 was probably the largest mass murder of civilians on U.S. soil?
I have known that since I first heard about the riot in the 10th grade. I'm probably the only person that may have talked to perhaps all of the survivors of the riot that lived in my community at that time. It became an obsession with me. I've heard George Monroe is a friend of mine from childhood, and I've heard him tell the stories. So the Oklahoma City bombing was pale in comparison to the destruction and loss of death in the Tulsa race riot. But you have to understand, the Tulsa race riot and its conspiracy of silence held for 75 years hidden, and it has corrupted our race relations in Tulsa till this day. It was part ethnic cleansing. It was almost certainly a holocaust. It's where white folks rioted and black folks were blamed. It was a riot where the ethnicity of the rioters were reversed. It was whites in reverse. Whites invaded the African-American community, burned, looted, and lynched. And 300 to 500 people, according to oral history, was killed. And it all was inspired. If it had not been the lie about the rape in the elevator, it would have been something else, because it was a conspiracy to steal strategically located land. I mean, that's what the riot was all about. Black folks had done exactly what white folks had told them to do. They had pulled themselves up by the bootstraps. They were alone and segregated. They had no relationship to the black community other than subservient role, and they played their roles well, and even that wasn't enough.
Well, Representative Ross, I'd like to ask you, have you had much resistance, or did you have much resistance from other people within the political establishment in Oklahoma in creating the commission?
Surprisingly, and I think Dr. Blackburn will agree with me, surprisingly, no. Initially, it would start a harbor old feelings and all of that. But I think for the most part, when we're knocked on doors, whether they're white or black, they've been open. There are still white survivors that I'm aware of who want to get it off their conscience, but family members are so embarrassed, they won't let them come forward. Huh. And the Tribune editorial that triggered a riot, I think your commentator was nice. It didn't say to lynch a Negro tonight. It said to lynch a nigger tonight.
Dr. Bob Blackburn, are you taking testimony from white survivors to hear what is happening? And why was this area called Black Wall Street?
Okay, the term Black Wall Street was coined by Booker T. Washington, who visited the West and realized that Tulsa in 1921 was a raw frontier oil boom town of about 75,000 people. It was the toughest of the tough people who thought they could survive on the frontier and find these jobs. And they had come west, and they were establishing their homes, as Representative Ross said. And by 1921, there were over 190 businesses in the North Tulsa community, and more than 1,500 residential homes spreading out from the Greenwood Commercial District. It was like a small town within a bigger town, because we had legal segregation in Oklahoma. The The first act of the Oklahoma legislature in 1907 was to pass a Jim Crow law of segregation. But it was a very prosperous community, and when Mr. Washington saw this, he said, "This is the Black Wall Street of America. This is a prosperous community." And so things were going very well at the time. Now, what we're trying to do, and when you asked about testimony, Representative Ross has been working on this project since 1971, when the 50th anniversary of the riot was commemorated. He helped publish some of the first accounts of it. Many people in the public in Tulsa and the state did not want to discuss this. It was something that they preferred to leave quietly behind as a tragic chapter in Oklahoma and local history. They did not want to discuss it. Gradually, that has changed. There have been books published on the riot. There have been editorials in the Tulsa World. In the Black newspaper in Tulsa, there have been documentaries produced. I think people are ready to talk about it. And our commission has started its work at the right time. I think people are now willing to speak up. We've had more than 500 new contacts with information since we began about 18 months ago. And of these 500 contacts, most are from white people who are finally saying, yes, my grandfather was involved in this slaughter, and it is time for us to add our information to what you know about this tragic episode. Those stories are coming forward. For example, there is one manuscript written by an 18-year-old at the time of the attack, later became a police officer, wrote his memoirs before his death in the 1970s, a very literate manuscript, and the family is now saying, we want this to be part of the record. It is almost an hour-by-hour account of the attack on the Black community.
Well, we have to go right now, but it's certainly a story we'll pursue. And have you dug up any mass graves?
Well, where we are right now, we have very strong evidence, archival evidence, of three mass burial sites. We think there are more, but we have very strong evidence of the three. We have archaeologists involved. We have Dr. Clyde Snow, a world-renowned forensic anthropologist who's been in Bosnia and Argentina. He is helping us. We think we are just weeks away from confirming the actual location of skeletal remains.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Bob Blackburn, Deputy Director of the Oklahoma Historical Society, and State Representative Don Ross, also George Monroe, survivor of the Tulsa Massacre. That does it for the show. 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call if you'd like to get an order of a cassette. Tomorrow or Monday, we'll give out a number if anyone wants more information. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Welcome to another session of Hot Talk from Cal Poly. I'm Saul Landau, your host, and here we are in the studios of the California